before the music, we were just talking about Michael Tobias, and we are going to be interviewing him today on Animal Voices. I'm really excited to talk with him. He's written so many books, I can't begin to name all of them, but some of the ones that jump to mind in terms of specifically dealing with animals is the novel Rage and Reason, as well as a book that he wrote called Voices from the Underground. And there's other books that he's written that deal more with sort of issues grappling with ideas around nature. A Vision of Nature is one of those books, and also there's a recent book called World War III, which deals with a whole bunch of different issues, specifically around overpopulation issues around that. So, Michael, are you on the line?
I'm here, thank you.
Thank you for being on the show today. It's great to talk with you.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
When I was thinking about how I could approach this interview, I felt a little bit overwhelmed because the body of your work is just so broad. You're a filmmaker, an author, probably do many other projects that I'm unaware of. But I was wondering if we could first maybe just talk about some of the films that you've done. So I've looked mostly at your books, but I was wondering if you've taken up issues around animals in any kind of substantial way within any of your films, and if so, how?
Yeah, I have. It's been my abiding passion for most of my life. But let me just say before I start, because of the times we live in, I think your listeners may appreciate the irony inherent to it, just as sort of a disclaimer that everything I say are merely my opinions.
Right.
And I mention that because within the animal realm, there has been such litigious and oppressive, really, incursions into free speech and almost free thought because of the battlegrounds at work, that one is almost forced to state up front that one harbors no ill will or wants to disparage anyone,
right,
even though the passions are very, very vivid and real. I mean, in my film work, you ask, you know, what sort of animal-related stuff that I've been involved with. Well, back in the mid-80s, I did a McNeil Lehr NewsHour piece on animal rights, which was one of the early films to really force the biomedical community to confront their detractors in a national news format. And we went to a few universities and put neurophysiologists and neurobiologists up against people in the animal rights world who were grievously concerned with the treatment of animals back in the mid-80s. Following that show and other films and books of the period, I think the biomedical establishment increasingly adopted a bunker mentality and pretty much segregated what they were doing from the public view, and that's where, of course, it's at today.
Yeah.
I later did a film in the late 80s called Black Tide, which looked at the causes and consequences of the Exxon Valdez disaster in Alaska and was particularly concerned with the impact of petroleum pollution on the biology of marine species and native terrestrial species. And it was, as you, and the numbers were just totally underestimated by the scientists who'd been hired by the oil industry to look into it. And the long-term biological consequences, of course, are still being tallied. And then right after that, I did a film called World War III, which I then did the book on. And that looked at the impact of human overpopulation on biodiversity throughout the world. And I was focused on the G7. I was focused on East and West Africa, on South Asia, China, Indonesia, Mexico, parts of the rainforest countries in South America, and, of course, the United States and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the list just goes on. I mean, I've just been continuing to hammer away at what I believe in with films and with books.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the good thing about films is that you graphically summarize your point of view visually and tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps there's a slightly better chance of getting your viewer to be there both mentally and emotionally on a level that is instantaneous.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're such a distracted global culture with respect to media, you've got to focus the attention graphically and immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And film can do that. So that has been a milieu which I have felt comfortable in. And right now, for example, I'm in pre-production on Mad Cowboy, a film with Howard Lyman,
right,
which will look at his story. I'm also about to do a sequel, a feature documentary sequel to World War III, which will be called No Vacancy, and we'll be shooting that all over the world as well. So it's just been an abiding passion of
yeah.
mine.
One of the things that I think is so amazing about film just as a medium, too, is I know from my own work around factory farming that I'll be, you know, sometimes giving a talk about animal agribusiness, and I feel frustrated that we can't walk through a battery cage facility, the whole class of us, for example,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that it's difficult doing work around the environment and around animal issues because you're always in a position that you're representing the other. And perhaps through pictures and film, that type of thing, that they're allowed to the degree possible, represent themselves. And so one of the reasons why I like that as a medium too. It speaks to people in a different way that words or, you know, the slides or whatever can't necessarily get at in the same way, sort of, you know, overheads and that type of thing.
Oh yeah. Well, I'll give you one really graphic example. In my work, I'm actually going to be screening it here at University of California, Santa Barbara, Monday afternoon for the faculty and the community. And that's in World War III. I opened the film with a absolutely death-defying montage of affliction going on throughout the world, from chained Asian elephants in India being forced to march and carry timber down the streets in New Delhi, to a scene on a rural country road in northern China where I was traveling with my crew to follow some family planning workers, and along came a group of bicyclists carrying live pigs chained to the backs of their bicycles. The pigs were weighing several hundred pounds. How these flimsy bicycles and flimsy riders were managing to transport them is anyone's guess, but they were indeed transporting them under unbelievable conditions to be slaughtered. We filmed all of this while it was happening. I totally lost it, if you will, mm-hmm. and completely forgot about the film crew and began negotiating immediately with the bicyclists to buy all of their pigs and release them into surrounding fields.
Mm-hmm.
We happened to have a United Nations vehicle with us as part of our little convoy, if you will. And so I was on my hands and knees untying all of these pigs and negotiating with a Chinese translator for their release and permanent safeguard. And we ended up going to contract there and then on the street as a huge crowd swarmed around us. We were able to rescue the pigs. But you don't know that until the end of the film.
Hmm.
All you know at the beginning of the film is that they're in terrible pain, and we've stopped them, and the pigs are now on the ground throbbing and writhing in agony, and we cut.
Hmm.
So throughout the film, you have this horrifying pit in your stomach of just having experienced terror.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end, they're liberated an hour later. And that's an example, I think, of something whereby you can, amid this evolutionary tumult of pain and absolute chaos on this planet, you can provide hope. You don't have to be daunted, and you can actually, even in your little microcosm,
mm-hmm.
provide a miniature example of liberation for all beings.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important.
Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly where all of your films have been shown. I assume it's far-ranging at this point, but in terms of North America, the culture here predominantly is very visually orientated, and there's a lot of violent imagery out there that is often, I guess, sort of, it's a blend of, I guess, fiction, nonfiction.
Uh-huh.
And I often wonder with animal rights imagery when I think about how we should use imagery. I'm often concerned that it will just be absorbed by this already violent visual culture. It just becomes another violent image among
uh-huh.
a series. And I was wondering how you sort of negotiate that or think about that. Do you think documentary is a bit different? Do you think that it's able to disrupt and still able to jar people in some way? Or do you also worry about it getting absorbed in ways that maybe you hadn't intended?
Yes, of course I worry about that, but I'm more concerned with tracking the impact and anticipating it stylistically so that the creation of the product, the film, or the book has a slightly greater chance of making impact.
Mm.
And I feel that because of the violence in this culture, and in most cultures, I know of very few cultures. I can speak to a few
mm-hmm.
that I would call spectacularly nonviolent, and I'd be happy to talk about that. But
right.
most cultures are, without question, steeped in 5,000 generations of human violence, and the predisposition is arguable, because if one goes back to the Serengeti and to our ancestors, there are certainly herbivores among us.
Mm-hmm.
But today there's no question that we crave violence for some reason, and the psychologists and psychotherapists and sociologists and TV critics can debate it forever, but there's no question that there's a culture of violence which perpetuates itself via any number of ways. And so it does concern me that the visualization of animal cruelty
mm-hmm.
can become yet just one more morning's newspaper
yeah.
to be cast away or used to carry fish home.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I go about confronting that is through moderation and restraint and intimation. And I feel that the human imagination is a very powerful tool. And if you give it something to work with
mm-hmm.
without hammering the nails on the coffin, you're likely to achieve a greater end result, because people will place themselves within another creature's life. That's the essence of biophilia. I think that's the cornerstone of the human contribution to nature. We're literally capable of formulating a new empathetic blueprint for the planet if we are only motivated to do so.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you'd like to talk about some of those examples that you see are of non-violent beings,
mm-hmm.
human beings, cultures, spiritual approaches, etc. And I know one of the approaches that you've looked at. I don't know if the Jains call it a religion. I don't know if it's an approach.
Either is fine.
Okay.
it's a religion. It's an ethical tradition. It's a culture. It's a history.
Okay.
It's a whole people.
Because you've taken that that up quite a bit in your work, and I was wondering if you could sort of outline some of the major tenets or what you see it can contribute to our thinking now.
Sure. Well, it's been around for a very long time. Mahavira, who was one of the great spiritual teachers, one of 24 acknowledged great teachers of the Jain tradition, was an elder contemporary of Buddha, and actually Buddha studied with Mahavira. Just to sort of set the context, Mahavira lived from 599 to 527 BC, and he was basically a spiritual seeker who spent the majority of his life walking barefoot across India, stopping in village after village to discuss problems of his time with local people, and was committed to nonviolence, or ahimsa
mm-hmm.
in Sanskrit, which also means non-interference but has multiple interpretations with respect to how one should take responsibility for problems around him or her. One of Mahavira's most famous moments, which is interesting because later on in the life of St. Francis you see an almost identical replay, was that his first sermon, Mahavira's first sermon, was known in Prakrit as Samavasarana, which actually means a congregation of people and all other animals. And so you have this vision of him in north central India, sitting there speaking to the pigeons and the foxes and elephants and tigers and the villagers about issues of nonviolence. I think what's important to think about with respect to the Jain community, who number between 15 and 20 million worldwide, there's mm-hmm. a fabulous community in Canada and East Africa, of course, in India, mostly Western India, throughout North America, in fact, other parts of the world, but it grew up in India, is that the Jains are expressly committed to nonviolence
mm-hmm.
and to tolerance and to empathy and to compassion and to doing good deeds. And most importantly, at least what really affected me about the Jains, is their ecological conscience. They really were revolutionaries in ecological thinking. Mahavira was a scientist. He was a botanist at a time when science was very frugal with respect to its acknowledgement of other species or the importance of other species.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even Aristotle in Greece, who was a well-known biologist, was apparently conversant with about 600 species. Well, Mahavira was conversant with tens of thousands of species, and he named them.
Mm-hmm.
And inherent to the whole philosophy of Jainism is the interdependency of every living being. and every living being's soul, which the Jains credit with an independent destiny that must be held sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this basic ecological preamble coming out of a Jain tradition, which is undeviating for thousands of years. Vegetarianism is key. Austerity, fasting throughout the year, low-impact consumerism, no gender disparity whatsoever, equality of the sexes, equality in the workplace, and an approach to even the smallest minute insect
mm-hmm.
with the same dignity and esteem as to your grandparents. And so this is remarkable. And I first went to India to make a film about the Jains, which I ended up doing, called Ahimsa Nonviolence for PBS. And we depicted the monks, the different sects, including the Digambara, who are naked. The male Digambara monks are absolute renunciates. They have no possessions other than a gourd for carrying water and a little broom made of peacock feathers that have fallen to the ground and they've picked up and fashioned into a broom to sweep away insects so that they harm no creature whatsoever. The film aired on PBS. It premiered on Christmas Day.
Mm.
And it was very graphic. There were probably 10 minutes of male frontal nudity, which is a sacred tradition among the Digambara monks. And it was understood in that context. There were no outcries from, let's say, fundamentalist groups in the U.S. about, my God, on Christmas to see, you know, naked monks walking around in India.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was completely accepted within the spirit with which it was given. And it told me a lot, because I subsequently got hundreds of inquiries and for more information about the Jains and people wanting to become vegetarian, and just an astonishment at the beauty and the elegance and the dignity of this one Indian tradition, which has had so much influence
mm-hmm.
around the world. So that's one community that has really absorbed me over the years.
Mm-hmm. And the Jains that you've met, are they hopeful about sharing their particular view, or is there sort of that quality about hoping to share it, or...?
I think there's great enthusiasm, and I think the young Jains particularly, of the Jains of this generation, are really intent upon conveying the wisdom of their ancestors. For example, in London, Atul Shah and his colleagues have created a magazine in company with some really fine people like Satish Kumar, the editor of Resurgence, who was himself a Jain monk.
Mm-hmm.
They've created a new magazine called Jain Spirit, which is fantastic. The Jains of North America have wonderful groups, and they do wonderful things, from taking donations to help flood victims or
mm-hmm.
typhoon victims, to working in hospitals, all kinds of charities. I mean, Chitrabhanu, for example, one of the leaders of the Jains, who spends his time between Mumbai or Bombay and New York, he and his wife and family are deeply immersed in animal rights issues. In fact, Chitrabhanu's wife is the head of PETA in India now, as I understand it. And
mm-hmm.
they're just extraordinarily turned on to exchanging views and trying to imprint the modern mindset of heavy consumerism, heavy commercialism, heavy greed, and heavy violence
mm-hmm.
with a tradition which has worked for them in their community for thousands of years. It's probably the most nonviolent, continuous, ethical community that exists on the planet. They're quite remarkable people.
Mm-hmm. That's I know I had the opportunity to be at an environmental studies sort of, I guess it was sort of a day-long series of talks that were going on, and I was a bit skeptical about being there, as I am just being environmental studies in general, because often issues around animals, specifically so-called farm animals, are neglected. And there was a Jain monk who had come to talk, and she was saying, you know, she's been vegan for however many years, and talked about sort of living in an urban environment as a Jain too, which was just great. And it was really refreshing for me to see issues around animals, and not necessarily wild animals, be brought into that forum,
mm-hmm.
which is something that I wanted to talk a little bit more about, in terms of these two streams in some ways that are parallel and overlapping with environmentalism and animal rights.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, as far as I can see, in many ways the environmental movement is an ally to the animal rights, animal movement. Yet there's also a reluctance on the behalf of many environmentalists to recognize or include the plight of animals, especially, as I said before, farm animals in their analyses and activism. And when animals are discussed within environmental discourse, it is often only those who fit within the realm of charismatic megafauna, which I know you talk about at least one of your books, such as whales and chimpanzees. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about this phenomenon, about sort of the overlaps between environmentalism and animal rights, and also the reluctance, if you've noticed it, maybe it's just me, around some of the environmental movement to recognize the suffering of animals.
Well, you've identified a very critical problem, and I'm so glad you have. It's one that definitely concerns me. Frequently, conservation biology and animal rights are at odds.
Mm.
There was an editorial page some years ago, I forget how many, maybe 10 years ago, in the Sierra magazine, which focused on the issue, on the question, do environmentalists have to be vegetarian?
Right. I remember that article.
It was just outrageous, because
yeah.
The answer was no.
Yeah.
That was the position taken by the opinion makers in that particular piece who were writing in. I couldn't disagree more. But to go to the roots of it, I think, challenges the same mindset inside and outside the environmental community. It's the public in general that has overlooked or refused to acknowledge the plight of farm animals. I mean, the numbers in the tens of billions worldwide are so staggering, and the conditions so Holocaust-like that one is almost paralyzed from speaking unless
mm-hmm.
you can somehow overcome an internal marathon of frustration and grief just to address the issues.
Yeah.
I think part of the root of the problem stems not so much from a lack of well intentions on the part of the general environmental community. It certainly doesn't stem from a lack of information. I think part of it stems from the persistence of moral hierarchies, by which I mean, it's one thing to save an entire forest, recognizing that by doing so, the habitat which supports, in some parts of the tropical Andes, for example, thousands of species per square kilometer, is patently animal rights at its most spectacular level, because you are, in fact, saving a generation of thousands of species and millions of individuals.
Mm.
That cannot be denied, I think.
Yeah.
On the other hand, when we speak about rights, and we speak about intergenerational and habitat rights, it's insane not to speak about individual rights. And so the conflict comes when policies, which are dictated to by fiscal realities, examine this kind of Bentham or John Stuart Mill utilitarian system of benchmarks, of benchmarking as it's perceived in the corporate world. That is to say, how much can we save, how many can we save, and what's the best strategy for saving them? This is a rubric which has been applied to the wildlands. So, for example, PETA, which just the other day announced success with the National Basketball Association, you may have heard of converting the leather basketballs to synthetic.
Right.
About 500 basketballs per year is, I believe, the number I saw, or something approaching that. Well, that's a wonderful hurdle. That's a spectacular achievement, because you're penetrating a conventional mindset that was overlooked and making an example. Then you can take the other example of, let's say, the donation of over $250 million to Conservation International in Washington by a couple for the express purpose of saving biodiversity hotspots around the world, of which, as you probably know, at least 25 have been identified.
Mm.
So you've got alpha and omega here, from the extreme of saving hundreds of millions of acres of land which is otherwise fated to be timbered or in some way destroyed, to the creation of a paradigm within a sports association where they will stop consuming leather basketballs. Those are two extremes. If you were to ask yourself, if you were to say that animal rights is the one that PETA did and conservational biology is the one that Conservation International did, you'd be right, but you'd fail perhaps to discern the fact that they're both doing the same thing.
Mm.
Where I get very agitated is when people dismiss the appeals of vegetarianism or veganism on grounds that it doesn't make a difference or on grounds that nature knows best or that evolution has doomed these genetically modified hybrid beasts, so-called, to be consumed by a superior race of beings, namely humankind. That's when I go berserk, because that just flies in the face of everything that I know to be true, of everything that I believe, and of everything, even if I didn't believe, that I would want to believe.
Mm-hmm.
So the plight of farm animals, the plight of billions of animals that are being sacrificed for this continuing consumerist monster, have to be addressed with the same zeal and commitment as do the wildlands that are being destroyed at unprecedented rates.
Mm-hmm.
So you simply can't separate in an ethical world the trespass upon wild species from the trespass upon so-called domesticated species. I tend to ignore the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I think beings are beings. Life is life. Feeling creatures need to be respected, need to be revered, and until the reverence becomes commonplace, we truly won't give this planet the status of a sacred being which she deserves. I mean, familiarity breeds love. It does not breed contempt. But the past few thousand years might suggest that it does. So I think that is, for me, the root of the delineation between environmentalism and vegetarianism, which translates into animal rights. And it really hinges upon this indifference to one side of the same story. And I think part of it is convenience. I think a lot of environmentalists simply do not want to change personal habits. And, okay, so people have to get there their own way. There's just not a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, when you have really great scientists like E.O. Wilson reminding us almost daily that at current consumer trends, 50% of all life on Earth will vanish in this century. I mean, you've got to step back and sit down and think about those numbers. And in the animal rights arena, specifically with farm animals, you've got the same catastrophic proportions going, but you don't have eminent scientists at Harvard and elsewhere reminding us of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem that we're facing,
mm-hmm.
how to achieve a higher level of legitimacy and of scientific debate, both within the legal, the psychological, and the environmental arenas for farm animals.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we've got to get to.
I often think of this image of farm animals sort of falling through this gap, because in many ways I think environmentalism has obviously contributed tons and, you know, does continue to do wonderful things and raises important questions. But there's sort of a sense that I found that environmentalism deals with the natural non-human world. And then there's sort of this dichotomy that's formed, this two sets, that's, you know, the humans on one hand and then grappling with these issues of the natural non-human world. And that farm animals aren't quite seen as wild, they're not natural somehow, and they don't get cast that way, although their ancestors certainly were, and so they're somehow beyond the realm or beyond the ethical sphere that needs to be looked at. And it's funny how, not funny, but it's strange how that seems to parallel geographically where farm animals are, that often, especially with factory farming, they're really super out of view. You don't have to think about them or see them or know where any of the products that you're eating necessarily are coming from, especially in terms of the meat and dairy industries. And that's also similar with animal experimentation. And it's strange to me how it's just so on the outskirts and beyond sort of even discussion or beyond conversation somehow. So I hope to see more environmentalists bringing this into the discussion as well, and not just having a focus on sort of species orientated,
yes,
but also looking at individual.
Well, certainly, there has been a resurgence of interest with respect to the consumption of petroleum and the trade-off, let's say, between the growing, the transport, the packaging of, let's say, a pound of soybeans versus a pound of meat. Those kinds of numbers have been looked at very seriously, and it's well known that, for example, if even 10% additional North Americans were of an increment of 10% were to go vegetarian, we'd probably save the total amount of oil that we import from the Persian Gulf.
Mm.
That kind of logic is very effective. Whether it translates into action is still the issue. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Not just within animal rights, but within every ethical,
yeah.
practical arena. I mean, in following, for example, the human population crisis and looking at contraceptive awareness prevalence rates in various countries, the one juggernaut, the real logjam, has been translating understanding and knowledge into action. Been in the family planning arena particularly difficult with the male member of the species.
Mm-hmm.
Females want to have contraception protection. They want to have access to a whole cafeteria style, if you will, of different options to protect themselves. But men have opted out, and you can't force anyone to do anything. The draconian measures in any sector are obsolete and morally repugnant and ineffective. They tried forced sterilization in India in the mid-70s. It was a disaster for Indira Gandhi. The draconian measures, which have translated into human rights abuses across China, are clearly not the way to calm the fertility boom. Within environmental circles and animal rights, there's a similar analogy. You can't force people to eat one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
Until we have an amendment to the Constitution of the United States mandating vegetarianism, we're going to be on very shaky ground. I do think that's coming, by the way, but it may be 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
For sure, we need a global vegetarian cartel, which could really muster political clout to sway human habits of animal protein consumption. And that would be a very major step. But getting to the individual rights, of which I referred to, it gets back down to a very personal methodology, which is an effective way to think about animal rights. I think we need to set examples for our friends, our parents, our colleagues, our children particularly. We need to set personal examples. We need to do things which are not mere gestures, but which actually make sense and convey empathy in its clearest possible terms. It's too easy to be daunted by the global problems. It's too easy to absolutely despair and turn inward. And I think one of the major lessons in the last 50 years from the animal rights world is patience,
mm-hmm.
and tenacity and clarity,
mm-hmm.
and fearing not to communicate. That has always been the case with respect to any major revolution. Sometimes you get lucky, and it happens quickly. I mean, when John Ruskin was read by Mahatma Gandhi, it changed him overnight.
Mm-hmm.
A little book, Unto This Last, about political economy, in which Ruskin was detailing the abuses of Dickinsonian England and comparing the exploitation of nature to the exploitation of people. And Gandhi got it. And he says in his memoirs that was the turning point for him. So sometimes that can happen. But I wouldn't count on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just a long road of selfless service, of speaking out, and of creating gestures of love that can be understood. And individuals need that. Every individual animal needs to be rescued from oblivion and indifference. And if you can achieve the salvation or liberation of one being in your lifetime, then you've done something spectacular.
That's a wonderful sentiment. I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about consumption levels and consumerism, specifically. My research has been within Western, the Western context, so looking specifically at North America. But it seems that any discussion around overpopulation development must also include a discussion around consumption levels as well and consumerism. And it seems that part of the sickness of Western culture has been to treat the entire natural world as a set of resources.
Yeah.
And this this resource mentality has a particular dire consequences for animals. And I was wondering if you could comment on sort of some within the environmental movement who advocate a better treatment of those resources, while others, to create a nice binary, others maintain that a radical rethinking of those of that resource mentality needs to happen. And I was wondering how you approach that sort of practically. Do you think that we need to make the conservation laws better to protect the forests, which, you know, will eventually, you know, be good for our lumber industry? Or how do you see sort of rethinking resource mentality within, I guess, the globe, within Western culture in particular?
Well, we have as an example probably the most graphic legacy imaginable coming from the Commonwealth. And that was, in fact, the British industrial imperialism is what John Ruskin was railing against. Because, I mean, the British Empire literally appropriated about 5 million square miles of tropics with the other superpowers in Europe, which was at the time about 85% of all developing countries. Today we talk in terms not so much of the political hegemony like that, but we speak in terms of NPP, or net primary production, the amount of chlorophyll producing terrestrial space which human beings have occupied and perverted, principally for monoculture. The consumption patterns, of course, are staggering. I mean, when you recognize that North America consumes about 25% of all resources on the planet, it constitutes a minute percentage of the overall human population, the dysfunctionalism is clear. And the World Trading Organization and the emergent Eurozone seem to be about safeguarding their protections to perpetuate the status quo. The recent farm bill in the United States is outrageous. It's all about subsidies. It's all about artificial pricing structures, which means, again, absolute disparity between those 20 countries at the bottom of the economic ladder who earn 1/37th per capita of the 20 richest nations, with over a billion, you know, malnourished individuals, many of them starving, and with 2 billion people off the power grid and half the human population, or over 3 billion, who've never even had the ability to make a phone call. Then you add on top of that the digital divide and the target areas for marketing, and you recognize that, if anything, consumer habits are reinforcing themselves. One had hoped that after 9/11 there'd be a rush of conscience. But in fact, curiously enough, after 9/11, many of the eco-labelers were complaining that it just wasn't working anymore, and they were going back to old, inefficient light bulbs. SUV sales were increasing. Mm-hmm. Hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles were taking a downturn. There were stalls throughout the landscape of alternative energy. And there seemed to be a reversion back to the self, because one could not cope with a violent world. And this translated into a kind of aphorism or mantra: don't bother me, leave me alone, it's business as usual, I hope. So the consumer patterns are critical to change. There are a number of groundswells that are very positive, like the ecological economics revolution and natural mm-hmm. capitalism and new approaches to auditing and resource depreciation as being part of GMP accountability. Mm-hmm. There are even calls now to force annual audits on the World Bank, which is a very good idea.
Mm-hmm.
There are changes happening in the legal arena. You've probably been following the Stephen Weiss and Lawrence Tribe mm-hmm. and others who are arguing for personhood rights being extended at least to our primate kindred spirits. But that needs to extend even further. And,
mm-hmm.
and I would urge you to, for example, consider some of the new amendments that are being debated to the Animal Welfare Act in the United States, which is kind of a bellwether in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just primitive. debates recently with respect to the increasing amount of space by the inches given to poultry,
mm-hmm.
so that perhaps they'll be able to turn around and preen themselves. These are minutiae that the animal welfare lobbies have been fighting incrementally to change, and you're well aware that the differences between, let's say, animal welfare, animal rights, and animal liberation are really three primary engines, if you will, for driving a whole new approach to resource use and to respect for animals. But it involves these multi-prongs. We've got to work to change in the legal arena. We've got to work in the economic arena, in the auditing arena. And that's why it's a collaborative effort and an interdisciplinary effort.
Mm-hmm.
And people are constantly asking me, do you see a way out of this cul-de-sac that the human species has gotten
mm-hmm.
itself into? It's so complicated. And my answer basically is, look, evolution does not condemn us. Only our choices can do that. Our individual choices either condemn or liberate us. It has nothing to do with destiny, nothing to do with evolution. We're free agents, and we've got to act responsibly, and that means stewarding and shepherding the creation, because we are a major part of it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
I wish we weren't. I really wish we weren't such a dominant force. I would love to see a planet of Todas, for example. That's a tribe in South Asia who are vegetarian, and they number 1,200, and they are just remarkably gentle, or the Karen in the jungles of Myanmar, also vegetarians. I mean, the list goes on of small societies, tiny collectives, blips on the biological map, that have managed to achieve absolute artistry, simplicity, grace, and nonviolence, and yet be very creative, inventive, productive human beings. If they can do it, we can all do it.
Mm.
Notwithstanding a 75% urban population on the planet, we can do it. And many people know that. I mean, the cultural creatives, so to speak, of which, you know, we're told there's some 50 million, I think there's more than that. In fact, some of the psychological studies about war show that at least 50% of the human population at any given time is committed to nonviolence.
Mm.
The other half, it's not so clear. Back in the 90s, Boutros-Ghali spoke about compassion fatigue at a time when something like 60 civil wars were erupting like wildfires across the planet, and it was impossible to cope, and charities started to go down. With the rise of the NASDAQ, charities started to go back up. So these, even compassion varies, but I have no doubt that we're capable as a species, that we have the reasoning faculties and the conscience and the voracious greed for knowledge to figure this out.
Mm.
But it's going to have to start with a respect for every individual, and that means the spider in your bathtub,
mm-hmm.
the lice in your hair, even the bacteria in your armpits. You've got to center yourself and figure out that all of life is precious. In fact, if we didn't have those bacteria in our armpits, we'd be dead.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to get it straight. And to ignore the plight of billions of creatures, for example, in the factory farm settings, is insanity. To ignore the hotspots is insanity. And to ignore the people who are suffering down the street is insanity. We've got to understand that it's all one balanced love fest, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and act accordingly.
Yeah. It's clear that nonviolence is a very central, important part of your ethic. And I was very curious when I was reading, I read Rage and Reason last term, and I was reading it, I wanted other people to read it so we could discuss it, but this book is pretty violent. It's actually exceedingly violent. In some ways, only the bad guys. Yeah. And then in some ways, right? But it's a response to an excruciatingly violent world and
yeah.
industries and all this. And I remember reading this, it's described on the back as the ultimate animal rights revenge novel. And I was wondering if you could explain why. Maybe you could give a...
Well, I didn't say that.
No. But I was just wondering why, if you could just maybe give us a synopsis of the book and then tell us about why you thought this was important to write this book?
Well,
and
this
what meant to you?
It was a fiction, yep. First and foremost.
Yes.
And you'll note the disclaimer in the front of that book.
Yes.
Which is
It's very lengthy. Yeah.
And it reinforces my absolute undeviating belief in total nonviolence. Notwithstanding that, the two characters in the book are mercenaries and vigilantes,
mm-hmm.
who do unto others what others do to animals. They target their prey very carefully, but yes, the fact is, as fictional characters, they engage in violent acts to try and remediate the world in some way, practically. I suppose you could call them eco-terrorists.
Right.
The goal of that book was to make readers contemplate the terrible dichotomy that exists within the human heart, namely, and hence the title of the novel. We are surrounded by violence. It is terrible. It is excruciating. It is uncalled for. It is criminal. There is a whole alternative, which is gentle and loving, that we could embrace with the snap of our fingers. And the characters, the two primary characters in Rage and Reason, mean to prove that to the readers by triggering great discord and chaos and uncertainty by the pathway which they personally choose within the fiction to redress the wrongs which have so tormented them, namely the slaughtering of animals and the wild the wild bird trade and mm-hmm. and fast food and so many things that they're the fur industry and so on that they're railing against. But my goal in writing that, one, was to vent my own frustrations artistically,
mm-hmm.
and to reflect on the sense of absolute futility that so many of us have felt in our lives against the greater avalanche of atrocities. It also derives from some of the studies that were done in the post-European Holocaust with respect to survivors across the world, and were survivors by fluke and by chance, and that even that put salt on old wounds, because why should they have survived and not others?
Mm-hmm.
Why this child and not another child? So the horror that we feel before violence and the pain and sense of absolute futility are feelings that I wanted to convey in the novel, but at the same time, I wanted people to feel that there were reasonable alternatives,
mm-hmm.
that there was a way somehow to expiate the human soul that's in pain and work toward collective, progressive, positive, nonviolent alternatives. There's actually a kind of, oddly enough, a happy ending in Rage
mm-hmm.
and Reason, which would have been impossible to predict. Certainly not happy for the animals that have perished. Certainly not happy for the animals that are perishing as we speak,
mm-hmm.
or will perish tonight. In slaughterhouses across the world, where they'll be tormented and tortured and slaughtered under unbearable, long-suffering conditions, with no UN speaking out for them, with no watchdogs or peacekeepers or anyone paying them any attention.
Mm-hmm.
To cope with that reality, which is happening 24 hours a day in millions of slaughterhouses across this planet, To pay respect to that is something we have to do, and we have to do more than that. We have to find ways to alter the mindset. And so Rage and Reason was just one small little artistic fiction to try to trigger a dialogue on these
mm-hmm.
issues.
We're going to have to wrap up soon, but I was wondering if I could actually just close with a quote from Rage and Reason that I loved.
Sure.
That I'll just read quickly,
okay.
and then we'll say goodbye.
Okay.
But talking about, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, Phelim?
Phelim, yeah.
He's talking about releasing birds, I believe, on page 66, and he says, "This night, Phelim's task was easy. Release them. Pray for them. Nudge them on their way into a new wilderness that one could only hope they'd make their own. The fruit and nuts were scarce compared with South American varieties. The land was relatively hard and unforgiving. There were competing organisms, other birds, raptors that they would not know about. Yet it was freedom, open sky, the chance to react to the universe again. I thought that was a fantastic quote.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for writing and doing all your work.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I really appreciate it.
It was wonderful to talk to you today.